Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
We're both humans. Neither of us are machines. We depend on a number of machines but to make this podcast happen, but we are both, for the most part, human beings.
So far, we are, yes. We have not been replaced by machines.
And to a certain extent, this show is our art, right? I mean, that's what humans do. Humans make art. It's kind of...
an expression of our humanity, our desires, our scary thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's this, this is kind of this output, this this expression of self that is kind of like the bat signal of human culture, letting everyone know that we've got it going on, that we are, and when I say everyone, I guess we're trying to tell the animals this, but what I'm saying is that we have for a long time just considered art as this thing that humans do, and it's uniquely human, and it's not the sort of thing that a machine could really manage.
Yeah, and we have talked about it a little bit in the animal world.
Yes, occasionally you can teach an elephant to paint.
Yeah.
You can get an ape to get in there and get its hands covered in paint and start dabbing around on
a
canvas.
And you have certain birds that may make their nest really, like, much more beautiful in order to attract a mate.
Yeah.
We've seen instances of this.
And ultimately, you can take things out of context and non-art, put them within an art context, and they become art. So, I mean, it's all in the eyes of the beholder. But we are the beholder, right? So
we're the ones
who get to decide what is art. We're the ones who get to make it. Or at least that is the way it has been.
But robots.
Robots are changing this. Robots are challenging our assumptions concerning what art is, who can make it, and what makes it good.
And actually what creativity is at the heart of the matter here. Studio360.com has some really great articles, a suite of articles on creativity and artificial intelligence. And that is in part what prompted us to start thinking about this today and podcasting on it.
Yeah. It's a great show. If you've never checked out Studio 360, give it a shot. We're talking about creativity and robots. Now, we did a whole episode on creativity, where it comes from in the human mind. So creativity in and of itself is a rather complex idea. There are several different definitions for creativity, which we explored in that episode in some depth. Some of these definitions are more easily applicable to robotic artists than others. For instance, there's the cognitive view of creativity. And this one, a computer could definitely do it because it's a process by which the sensory input is transformed, reduced, elaborated, stored, recovered, and used. So it's just an input-output scscenario here.
It sounds like memory retrieval as well, right?
Yeah, and you can see this kind of quote-unquote creativity at work in simple. You'll find programs online where you input text and we use a cut-up system to mesh it around and change it. Random. If you were to do like a random filter on a photograph, I mean, it's a very simple version of what we're talking about. But essentially, data is inputted, data is changed, and data is outputted.
Right.
Then there's like the psychoanalytic Freudian view, which argued that creativity is an occurrence of the subconscious. This not so easily applicable to machines.
Well, we'll get into this in a little bit, but there is a aspect of this that is happening in artificial intelligence. But yeah, there's this idea that art occurs, creativity occurs sometimes from these different states of consciousness, and particularly with unconsciousness. In fact, Salvador Dali supposedly would sit with a spoon in his fingertips, holding it over a tin cup or plate as he drifted off to sleep, and then the spoon would fall from his grasp and wake him up again, and presumably he did this so that he could spend longer on the fringes of consciousness, unconsciousness, and retrieve new ideas.
And there have been other artists that have done that with a silver spoon before, but in different ways.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say a chainsaw.
Okay, other quick definitions of creativity. There's the behaviorist view, which says that creativity is a combination of previously known knowledge joined together spontaneously. and which gives the impression of a new idea or inspiration. So this is kind of an idea collider idea of creativity. And that matches up really easily with our ideas of machine intelligence,
mm-hmm.
that a machine without any kind of real gusto could get in there and say, okay, zombies are good and Pride and Prejudice is good. 1 + 1 = 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm using creativity. I mean, that's a very... granted, that idea was generated by a human, but it's very easy to imagine a machine coming up with that as well. Like looking at, say, you know, if you had a computer that was analyzing like search terminology mm-hmm. online, seeing what people were searching for, and just picking the top two categories and crafting a novel.
So it's very much like decision tree.
Yeah.
Decision making.
Yeah.
And so the question arises, can there be a purely creative product that comes out of a machine?
Yeah.
And the other question is, you know, is this sacred ground? Is it really unique to humans? And that's what we're going to really get to explore today.
Yeah, it's an interesting look at just what computers are capable of now and an idea of where they're going. But also, it really forces us to reevaluate what's going on in creativity and what's mm-hmm. going on in art. And it just really forces you to reexamine how we view the whole scenario. So we should probably start in the written word.
Right? Ah, robotic fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. And apparently this has been around for a while, right? There's something called Mark I Baby. And in 1952, a British computer scientist, Christopher Strachey, programmed the Mark I Baby computer to generate love poetry from a database of romantic verbs and nouns.
Yeah, back in the 50s.
Back in the 50s. And here's a sample.
Okay.
I'm not going to read it in
voice. Oh, read it in a robot voice.
Really? Okay, yeah. I'll try. I mean, you know how well I do with other accents.
Well, the robot accent is pretty easy.
All right. Honey, love. My anxious fondness impatiently yearns for your craving enthusiasm. You are my breathless infatuation, my darling affection, my ardent liking, my covetous fancy. Yours anxiously, M.U.C.
There you go. That was good.
That was okay.
I mean, I'm sure the computer is listening. We'll probably be a little offended
by your
accent.
The computer is wincing right now. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, here's an early example of this. But, you know, fast forward to today, and we have something called Brutus, which is a machine fabulist.
Yeah, Brutus uses mathematical equations that are based on the basics of plot, of setting, of dialogue. And really, this, if any of you that have ever taken classes on the structure of a novel or how to write a short story, you know that there are formulas out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also look at it, like there's so many different guys out there and women that are, that have like these models of how to plan out a novel, how to plan out a short story. And they're like triangle approaches and multiple story arc approaches. And there's like a snowflake approach to writing a novel, and it's so we're really big on formulating it and really guiding it out, as if to make it to where just anybody could follow these instructions and
mm-hmm.
come up with a novel. So it follows. It's really easy to imagine then a computer taking some of this data and using that information as an equation to generate a novel. It knows the structure of plot, the way a story tends to roll, and it can generate that.
Yeah, and I mean, it is really cool, actually, the fact that it can generate these stories. Now, there are limitations. I mean, we're talking about 500-word stories.
Yeah.
And programmer Selmer Brinkjord, he said that the program can't be considered creative unless the machine creates something that's completely demystifies the programmer. So, in other words, if it's not demystifying and it's putting out the expected
mm-hmm.
outcome, then it's just cloning our intelligence.
Well, see, this reminds me a lot of the scenario of fan fiction with human writers. This is a pretty simple concept that everyone's encountered. Take say someone like H.P. Lovecraft wrote a ton of short stories and fragments and the occasional slightly longer work with a very particular brand of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people that read, and I mean, I I think I've probably read most of his work. But you have people that read most of his stories, if not all of his stories, and then it's pretty easy at that point to sort of regurgitate something that is at least Lovecraft-ish.
In that style.
Yeah, you figure out what he tends to do in a story, what format he tends to follow, and then you can make something that's Lovecraft-ish. And certainly there have been a lot of authors who have enjoyed some success with Lovecraft-ish stuff. But where you really see something phenomenal is when someone is clearly inspired by someone like Lovecraft, mm-hmm. or various other authors that have that certain feel and look of their own material, where they can take what that author's done and then spin it around, do something different with it in a way that makes it their own.
Well, see, and this comes, the originality really comes into question in mm-hmm. these sort of cases, because you could argue that there is nothing, nothing unique has ever really been created.
Right.
That it's just...
To a certain extent, we're all taking ideas, colliding them,
yeah.
And trying to put just enough spin on them that we don't get sued.
It's just iteration of iteration of iteration, unless you're Da Vinci, right?
Yeah.
Just coming up with all these completely original ideas for new machines and
concepts.
But that's
because he stole a time travel machine.
I knew it.
See, I knew it.
You finally said it. It's true. This idea that this program is spitting out stuff that's not too original. Well, okay. I mean, you really get into shades of gray of like, well, what, at what point does it become in the realm of uniqueness and just regurgitating a bunch of rules?
Yeah. And are you, which model of human creativity are you holding it up to? Are you holding it up
yes.
to the Sistine Chapel? Are you holding it up to Dante's Inferno? Or are you holding it up to Pride and Prejudice with zombies?
Which is the main problem of subjectivity, right? When it comes to art. Okay. So I did want to say that Brutus created this short little story here, and he paints a picture of a guy named Dave Stryver. He's a PhD candidate, and he's ambivalent about his current situation. Mm-hmm. And the program puts dashes of details in there. Just as you said, like there's very formulaic in some ways, just to create the setting. Brutus says, here's the ivory clock on the campus and eager students. So you start to get a real sense of place. And the pacing also gives it a sense of drama and foreboding. And I wanted to play just a really short clip of this. This is from Studio 360. And this is a moment in which Dave Stryver is being waylaid by the dissertation committee for his PhD.
Fiery and uncontrollable rose up. Dave, Professor Hart prodded softly. God, they were pitiful. Pitiful, pallid, and puny. Dave, did you hear the question? Later, Stryver sat alone in his apartment. What in God's name had he done?
And it should be noted that that was not the robot's voice. That was human reading.
Yeah. That was a real dude reading. You kind of do get a sense of that, right? That's not too bad.
Yeah.
For a computer to sort of spit that out, and for it to make sense in the first place is kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. But for it to give you a sense of peering into another person's mind, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Because does a machine know what a human mind is?
Well,
certainly learning about it.
Yeah, because ultimately, the machine is dealing with language, which is kind of like a shadow of the human mind. It's, it's dealing with coded data, semiotic web of meanings and symbols, and if you align it properly, you can create a text that has either a little or a lot of meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just to what extent can the machine understand the human mind, I think.
Yeah.
And to that end, it turns out that Patrick Winston, he's a principal investigator at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, he is teaching Macbeth to computers.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that storytelling makes it possible to teach, to learn, and to be creative. And so he wants these machines to understand humans, and what better way than to start off with Shakespeare?
Yeah, and as far as teaching, learning, and creating go, human beings go a pretty long way with just faking any or all three of those categories. So really, as far as understanding the human mind,
yeah,
that's really not even as important necessarily for a machine as just the semblance of it, faking it, because if it can create something that we end up investing thought into, then that is the insight into the human mind, right? Maybe I'm getting ambiguous there. I don't know.
Well, I think what you're saying is that the simulation at some point becomes the thing.
Yeah.
Right? So even if it doesn't truly understand it, if it's executing the code for it.
I mean, because we've all encountered art, be it, you know, so be it a work of written art or visual art or music, where we take that moment and we think, is this person brilliant or are they just pulling one over on me, you know?
Well, now machines have the same opportunity.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, okay, this guy who's teaching them, Macbeth, he actually has a point here beyond just human mind comprehension here. It's actually to try to help creatively problem solve, which would make sense with storytelling. And he says that what we're hoping to do is build systems one day that are as important to a political analyst as a spreadsheet is to a financial analyst. We have a system now that draws parallels between various kinds of historical events, the Arab-Israeli war and the Tet Offensive, for example. Finding those parallels could help keep people out of trouble.
Okay, so now we're getting into a larger area then of robotic design. Not just robotic writing, but just robotic creative thought.
Well, and it reminded me of the Living Earth Simulator that we've talked about mm-hmm. before, which is this idea that you could take every bit of data in the world, throw it in there, and try to predict what's going to happen next, whether it's a weather pattern or, you know, politics, or even economic ramifications throughout the world.
I'm currently reading the Hyperion series by Dan Simons, and in that novel, you have you have artificial intelligences that have seceded from human civilization, and that still advise on various levels and are still involved, but also rather separate. But they have it to the point where they know exactly how everything is going to transpire for years and years in
yeah.
the future, with the exception of one sort of X factor that is pivotal to the novel. But yeah, back to the Living Earth Simulator, just the idea that if you put enough, you put the information in there,
mm-hmm.
To what extent can a machine navigate all the variables and come up with an accurate prediction of how things will play out?
Well, we've talked about the limitations here with a Living Earth simulator because mm-hmm. it doesn't take into account, or this version of it, as of yet, hasn't been able to take into account what we call these black swans, or these events that seem to come out of nowhere.
Right.
But when, in fact, you look at it, like, you know that there's going to be some sort of entropy at some point. It just feels like it came out of left field because we didn't expect it.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like human creativity, you know, We'll have one thing in mind, then something else comes along, and it changes the form of what you're trying to create. You know, I mean, like I remember I started writing a short story before my dad died, and then after my dad died, that changed the shape of that story. Like that was a black swan event. I mean, people die. That's kind of it kind of happens all the time. So not in the sense that it's that unforeseeable an event.
Mm-hmm.
But it occurs and it changes the direction of the creativity. So what you're saying here is that we have to have a creative program that is also that we throw a few black swans at every now and then.
Well, that could also create its own black swans.
Ah.
And we should probably take a break here. And when we get back, though, we're going to talk about whether or not there is a machine that can break this kind of code and possibly even create new, unique thoughts.
All right. All right, and we're back. And, we're going to talk about a little something here called the creativity machine.
Yeah, okay, so...
Which exists. This is not a, something that we read about in a science fiction novel or something.
I know.
Or something like the Earth simulator. Not like the Earth simulator that may exist in the future that we're
mm-hmm.
planning. This is something that is out there.
I actually thought about the Santa Claus machine reading about this, and we talked about this in another episode. That, of course, is something that could exist in the future, but does not exist now. Okay, so let's get to this creativity machine. It is pretty much like the ultimate problem-solving machine. There's a guy named Stephen Tholer, and there's a great documentary called In Its Image that covers this.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 70s, he has been futzing around with artificial neural networks, and he has conducted a lot of experiments with us. Usually people have been dealing with artificial neural networks just to kind of see the way that the brain processes information.
Right.
But he has a different plan with his creativity machine by using the human brain and trying to not only replicate the way that neurons, the neural network is working, but also how originality arises in humans. He's trying to do the same thing in computers, and you could argue that he has done it.
Yeah, the creativity machine learns on its own,
mm-hmm.
and it deals with black swans.
Yeah, let me get
mathematical variables that are thrown in to shake it up.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's got these human-generated scripts. It is an artificial neural network, but it has two distinct functions. One part contains data, and one part runs that data with tests and gives it feedback. So that's where it learns from itself. And then occasionally, Solar will actually disrupt these functions by running mathematical noise into the system.
Okay, that's the black swan.
That's the black swan, which creates a false memory of confabulation. And this is where the machine gets confused, and it begins to drive the artificial neural network to think in new ways and produce new ideas. And here's an example of this. Fuller was actually commissioned by Oral-B, the toothbrush maker, to create some new designs for the toothbrush, or their toothbrush, as I should say. And he said that when they injected noise into the first network, it imagined not the memories of toothbrushes it had previously seen. It produced confabulations, false memories that were hybridizations of what it had seen before.
Hmm.
So when he threw that black swan in there, all of a sudden it did create these original new thoughts that were based on those memories. So it retrieved its memories, but they were false memories,
huh.
Which is really sort of the same thing that happens when we have our own aha moments in creativity, right? We have
yeah.
these breakthroughs based on our the experience, the memories, but, you know, it kind of comes out in a bit differently. He says, you know, I didn't do anything crazy here. I basically pushed a return button and sat back and watched 2,000 designs emerge. And then he gave the customer, Oral-B, 200 designs.
Huh.
Okay, so that sounds like, okay, Oral-B toothbrush, whatever. This guy has actually used this machine to create everything from like snack food to military devices like robotic swarms.
Yeah, it's been used to create substances harder than diamonds, 1.5 million new English words. It's trained robot cockroaches, and it's composed just a whole lot of music.
Yeah, which is really cool. And we'll listen to a clip of that music in a moment. But this is a really cool thing too. Fuller actually filed the first patent for the autonomous generation of useful information. And then his second patent was for his self-training neural network object. Patent 2 was invented by patent number 1.
That's crazy. That's amazing.
The machine created the patent. I mean, this really does kind of spell out a very interesting future mm-hmm. with this technology. He says that this is the way that we're going to cure cancer and the way that we'll do multi-trillion dimensional optimizations to bring some peace of mind for the world's economy. Okay, so think back to the Living Earth Simulator.
Yeah.
And its limitations. If you were to marry the two technologies, is there the possibility that this machine could become like, you know, basically a crystal ball for us?
It could be like Oral-B comes to the AIs then and says, hey, we want to roll out a new toothbrush, but we also want to know how this toothbrush will change the world. So the computers begin to say, all right, here are 10 designs you can choose from, and here is a layout of how each of these designs will affect your financial well-being as well as the world at large.
Right, because you could overlay all that data, right? You could
yeah.
say, if you decide to produce it in this area of the world, this is the impact it will have on that economy mm-hmm. and on those people. You know, if you did it here, it would have this sort of impact, so on and so forth. You could look at its carbon footprint. I mean, you could look at all sorts of slices of data on top
yeah.
of this.
Yeah, and ultimately, that's what the Living Earth Simulator comes down to as well. It's not really so much an idea that we will create a virtual reality Earth 2. It's
yeah.
it's the idea of, well, we have in this simulation as much data as we want to throw at it. So you would say, all right, I'm interested in making toothbrushes, so I want to know how this device might affect, you know, this particular hygiene market, how it'll play out, you know, legally, how it'll play out with profits, how it will play out with, you know, with the perception of the brand, you know, whatever the variables happen to be, as long as you have the data to back it up.
Yeah. Of course, you know, you would have to mesh these two technologies, and that right there is the fiction part of this, but those two technologies do exist, standalone. Mm-hmm. And so it's very, exciting to sort of extrapolate what that might look like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I think that this is a great opportunity to hear a little clip of music by this machine. It's actually called the Dingularity. And this is from the album Song of New Neurons. And again, this is from Studio 360.
All right, but we're talking about art here, so let's really get down to the paintings now, to the canvas itself. This is nothing new either. There are any number of robots out there that have been designed to put a little paint on a canvas. On a very basic level, we have robots out there painting cars every day.
Right.
The work's pretty basic. It tends to be it's very often one color, but it is a robot painting something. So it's very easy from there to extrapolate robots painting various other things. Like I said, we've trained elephants to paint. You get an ape's hands dirty, it will paint something on a canvas. We have machines that are capable of this as well. I mentioned a few of them here that are fairly interesting. For instance, there is the Van Gogh bot, as in Vincent Van Gogh.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular bot boasts 18 brushes, a paint mixer, and 3D spatial awareness. So, and it can combine artistic influences to create fresh takes on a given subject. So the variables here being a subject and what styles you want to see. So you can sort of think of this in terms of almost like an Instagram kind of a thing. Imagine if a robot were in charge. All right, the photo is of a dog, and say I wanted to combine filter 1 and 2, and it would combine those in a way that made sense. So you might say, all right, I have a picture of a bowl of fruit. I would like that in a way that's cubist and also surrealist.
Well, and then there is what seems to be a more nuanced program called Aaron.
Yes.
Right? And this is where you get more of the expression, I guess you could say, even in the eyes of the people that it's depicting in its paintings.
Yeah. Now, Aaron has been going since about 1973, mm-hmm. Or the project itself. And it's the brainchild of Harold Cohen. Aaron draws and paints stylized still lifes and portraits of human figures out of its programmed, quote-unquote, imagination. No images or additional human input is necessary. So it sees something, and then it creates an artistic interpretation of what it sees.
Which would point to original thought, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, and don't worry, though.
And ultimately, the thing, again, it's like once it's created, like it creates this thing on canvas that then interacts with the human mind. And we've talked before about all the stuff that goes on in the human mind when you look at a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even if it's not thinking about subtext or whatever, it's not actually quote unquote thinking. If the piece ends up summoning that thought in the viewer, then it's art.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've seen some of the examples, and you can go to studio360.com and see the samples of them. That's a good place to start, at least. But some of them really do elicit some feelings, mm-hmm. I have to say, but there is a flatness to it that you can kind of tell that it's computer-generated. But that being said, I can't remember the first name of the artist, but it's Freud's grandson or something. There were some scenes of people that reminded me of Freud's paintings that have a certain mood to them, a certain quality,
mm-hmm.
In the way that it's spatially arranged. And I thought that was interesting because I thought, well, there seems to be some sort of psychology going on in this painting.
Yeah. But then again, that reminds me of any number of cases of You'll see like an interview with an artist or an actor or a musician, and they'll be like, oh, you know, when you did this particular thing, when you decided to paint this blue instead of gray, or, you know, what was going on in your mind? And they'll have all of this thought invested in this, mm-hmm. in this one little detail. And then when the artist just says, oh, yeah, well, we ran out of gray paint that day, or, you know,
right.
Or it'll be something like, oh, yeah, well, it's different live than it was in the album because we kind of forgot how the music, how we actually played it the first time. You know, there ends up being some sort of mechanical explanation for something that you thought was going to be really just tied into the creative process.
Well, so much of that then is projection by the viewer, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so just in case you were worried that there wasn't some sort of computer around here to try to take the highly subjective job of making the stance that some art is good and some art is bad, don't worry, there's something called DARCY. It's the Digital Artist Communicating Intent machine. And it's essentially kind of like an art historian. They are teaching this computer to basically build a database of artwork in order to carry out this subjective task of saying this is good and this is bad. And basically it associates images with an adjective. Mm-hmm. And it can learn, it can build up this database and begin to learn what is considered good and what is considered bad. And then you can actually throw another image in front of it and it will rate it. Which is interesting. Computer scientists from Brigham Young University actually have been working on this.
And we missed it when it came to Atlanta.
Yes.
It came to the High Museum of Art and judged the works of man.
It did. Yeah. It dashed a lot of people's hopes to be artists. Apparently a couple of kids, too, got some thumbs down from DARCY. All right, so let's talk about film. Could a computer be an auteur of sorts in this medium?
Well, certainly we're dealing with fiction, but with film, with digital film editing, it's all digital. All that information is just data in the computer. And again, this is another area where there are certain rules. There are certain types of cuts. There's a certain law that you abide by when you're editing a film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfectly believable that you could hand over the raw footage and the basic flow of the piece, and you could expect a machine to give you some results. Whether it would be the results on par with, you know, work of a great film editor, well, that's the discussion.
Well, yeah, that's just the question mark here. The film is called White on White Algorithmic Noir, and it's by Eve Sussman, and it's kind of billed as a paranoid sci-fi thriller. And Eve Sussman says it's about an American engineer, Holtz. He gets a job in a mysterious foreign place called City A, mm-hmm. and starts finding out things are wrong. The water supply seems to be drugged with lithium. Time seems to be slowing down. People are running out of language. And the people who hired him may not be who he thinks they are. So everything is a little bit beyond his control in this situation.
Very Kafka-esque kind of a scenario, right?
Yes, very Kafka-esque. And it actually is very interesting to watch it. And here's another reason why it's interesting, because every time you watch it, it is a different scenario because of this computer program, which is essentially re-editing the film every time you view it. Eve Sussman worked with programmer Jeff Garneau, and he designed the computer system. So there's no one version of White on White.
This is interesting because this ties into some of the ideas we've discussed about the future of music, like the idea that in the future we won't listen to a piece of music that was composed by an author or an artist, rather, but we would listen to a piece of music composed by an artist that then tailors itself to our particular taste and needs or an environment. So,
which is just like the robotic piece of music. It's called Emily Howell.
Yeah.
Or that's the program. David Cope designed it. And it composes classical music based on influences from Bach and Mozart.
Huh.
And some people say that you can't tell the difference at times. So that's interesting that you say that. Because if you knew that you were interested in that, and then that's what it was inspired from, then it would no longer be actually the works of Bach and Mozart.
Like, think of some of the films that have, like, they're famous for multiple cuts. The one that comes to mind most obviously and most fitting for this conversation is Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Where some cuts lean more towards Harrison Ford's character being a replicant, an android, an artificial person, versus him being a human. So what if you had, in the future, what if a cut of Blade Runner tailors itself to your particular values. If you're the kind of person who is more satisfied with Harrison Ford being a robot, then that is the version you end up seeing. Likewise, if you're the kind of person who thinks Han Solo should shoot first or he should shoot second, then a copy of Star Wars tailors itself to what kind of a viewer you are.
Well, then.
Oh, and then to say nothing of curse words, nudity, violence.
Right.
You could have the film automatically adjust itself to the age of the viewer, or even the sex of the viewer.
But then
if
it's no longer
versus males. There are sort of demographical variables in play.
It's no longer tied though to that particular person's perspective, and is no longer the artwork of that person. Correct.
Well, you would have to have some variable. Like, for instance, the language thing is pretty easy. Like, there are artists out there where they'd be like, oh no, you can't have Scarface say, dang it. This character's cursing is important to the work, and if you take the cursing out, then it's no longer that work. But there are
the My Little Cockroaches? Is that
yeah.
The part?
Yeah. You could okay. Leave the cockroaches, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
But I feel like there are other films out there where the artist would probably say, no, I don't think it harms my artistic vision if they say fudge instead of the F word.
Oh, I don't know. Fudge is a very different thing than the other thing.
Well, maybe, yeah. But you get my point. I think it depends on the level to which the work adjusts itself.
Okay, well, and I suppose it depends on the author of the work too, and how she or he intends it to interact with
right.
Well, take the consumer of it.
Take Brazil, for instance, Terry Gilliam's
yeah.
film. There was a like a happy ending cut of the film that the studio did, which is horrible, but it has a very happy ending. Whereas the actual cut of the film has a really down ending.
Yeah,
like even the sort of even the compromise, the cut that they ended up putting together is really kind of a downer. If you had a version of if Brazil tailored itself to your viewing and would sometimes choose the happy ending, then that would definitely compromise the piece.
Again, I think it all goes back to what the person is trying to say with that particular piece of artwork.
Okay, yeah.
Which goes back to robots. Do they have a particular perspective when it comes to that? You know, can they really have a perspective? You feed them lots of data about the environment. If they can learn from themselves and create original thought, there's the possibility there, right?
Yeah.
But let me, before we get too far into that, I do want to play this clip of Emily Howell. This is the music that we're talking about that is inspired by Bach and Mozart, just to give you guys a sense of what that sounds like.
Now, I'm not the biggest connoisseur of classical music, but I certainly, I don't think I'd be able to tell you if that was Bach, Mozart, or a computer.
No, and I think that the issue that a lot of people are having with this iteration of music, at least, is that there's not a standout piece yet. And even David Cope, who designed it, says, like, there's not anything too terribly creative or original about this music.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a variation on a theme that someone else has done before.
Right.
So eventually, though, presumably, there is going to be some sort of breakthrough, some sort of piece of music created by a machine, possibly even the creativity machine, that people say, oh, wow, this has really struck a chord in me as a human. It reached this center of emotion in me that I didn't think that a robot could inhabit my perspective in order to elicit that feeling.
Mm.
So then the question becomes, well, who is the artist here then? Is it the programmer or the computer? And at what point do we consider human creativity be the same as machine creativity? And here's the other question I have, because we've talked about human cyborgs and the way that we are always manipulating ourselves
mm-hmm.
with technology. Is this just another way to manipulate our abilities? So is this part of the human experience to some degree?
Yeah, like when a human creates a robot that then creates art, is that human just creating via proxy? Is it kind of like saying, like looking at the difference between me singing and me creating music with a trumpet? I'm with mm-hmm. the trumpet, I'm using a piece of technology that amplifies and changes my output into a different type of output. but it's still dependent upon my original output.
Yeah, I know. It's like it's an extension of creativity, right?
Right.
Just because you use something to express yourselves, albeit a machine, it doesn't mean that it's not somehow an expression of the human self because we're the ones who coded it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it boils down to this idea of consciousness. I really do, and I think that the creativity machine and its ability to mimic these little blips in consciousness. I'm not going to call them unconsciousness because. Mm-hmm. That's probably giving a little bit too much credit, but I think until we can really crack this nut of what consciousness is, we can't really answer the question about whether or not robots could emulate it or create truly unique art.
Yeah, because, when you get into the motivations, like something like Dante's Inferno, the artist wants to create this piece, and he wants to create a piece that... That says something about God, that says something about faith, that says something about the world that he lives in, that takes jabs at people that he doesn't like. All these things that go on in so many works of art, where there's a little bit of themselves in the work as well.
Yeah.
To what extent can a computer ever pull that off?
Well, so some would argue that humans have been creating art for at least 35,000 years, right? Like from cave drawings up to creating a program like Aaron that can create art.
Right.
And that machines have only been creating art for about 40 years. So that, we just need to give them a chance.
Yeah. Because when we were 40 years in, we weren't really all that impressive either. So.
Right. So, and because they can carry things out at much more rapid speeds than we do, presumably they could become pretty sophisticated artists. I don't know. Or, is this predicated on this idea of a soul? And, this is for another podcast, but
it's for the next podcast, because we're going to get into
personhood.
Oh, that's
true. We are going to talk about
that. But before we do that, we have to close this one out. So.
Indeed.
So there you have it. Some thoughts on the computer as an artist, the art as a creation of machine versus a creation by man, and then as a work that is ultimately viewed by a human, or in the case of Darcy, by a computer. So we would love to hear from you guys. What do you think about that? What is art? Do you think a computer can really create music, literature? Or visual art in a meaningful way, and then how much of it just does it depend on the viewer or the reader or the listener as to whether it's art or not? Let us know. We'd love to hear what you think. I have just I'll read one quick listener mail if we want to call the robot over here. It's always a little awkward calling the robot over here.
After we've been talking about robots.
Yeah.
Hey, Artie.
All right. Now, this one is related to movies. Our listener Sean writes in about horror and talking about old versus new horror. Sean says, really quick, my observation on new horror versus old horror in the mental versus the visual. The old schoolers like Hitchcock and King left what happened next up to the mind. Now, with modern technology, they show you the gore and leave nothing to the imagination. I know there are exceptions, but I feel new horror is no more scary than it is disturbing. I also find myself more frequently feeling that new horror glorifies individuals with psychotic tendencies, especially when the character is based on a real individual. Great job every week. Mad love, Sean. I've certainly seen that argument that now horror is more about just really throwing up disturbing images, but even then, it's like I feel like when horror movies show disturbing images, it's like that you desynthesize to that so quickly.
Yeah.
That even if a disturbing image is going to be effective, it needs to have an underlying disturbing idea. And sometimes I think that the disturbing image actually gets in the way of the idea. And to tie this back into what we're talking about today, I sometimes feel like when you look at horror that seems to work or almost works, and because you think that there is a disturbing idea at the heart of it,
mm-hmm.
and in some cases it just seems to turn out that the creators of this particular piece are just. They're just dealing in the visuals. They're just dealing in the disturbing images side of it. And any disturbing idea beneath it is just the viewer's perception. So you get into ideas of, you know, something can actually seem to have more ideas and more depth to it based on what the viewer, the listener, the reader is bringing to the
scenario. So again, projection.
Yeah. So, yeah, let us know what you think about computers creating art. You can find us online. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And you can find us on Twitter, where our handle is Blow the Mind.
And you can also drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.